Focuses on one of the most difficult challenges that can confront a family, the painful situation that arises when a child becomes a criminal. The reader is Kerry Shale.
I walk in the rain by your side. I'll cling to the warmth of your tiny hand. I'll do anything to help you understand. I'll love you more than anybody can.
Unlike most of the conditions discussed in this book, criminality is the child's fault, something he has done deliberately and with choice. It is also the parents' fault, something they could have prevented with decent moral education and adequate vigilance. These, at least, are the popular conceptions. And so, parents of criminals live in a territory of anger and guilt, struggling to forgive both their children and themselves. On the 20th of April, 1999, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, seniors at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, placed bombs in the cafeteria, set to go off during the first lunch period at 11:17 a.m., and planned to shoot anyone who tried to flee. Errors in the construction of the detonators prevented the bombs from exploding, but Klebold and Harris nevertheless held the whole school hostage, killing 12 students and one teacher, before turning the guns on themselves. The number of people killed that day is generally listed as 13, and the Columbine Memorial commemorates only 13 deaths, as though Klebold and Harris had not also died that day in that place. Contrary to wide speculation then, and since, the boys did not come from broken homes and did not have records of criminal violence. The wishful thought of a world that witnessed this horror was that good parenting could prevent children from developing into Eric Harris or Dylan Klebold. But malevolence does not always grow in a predictable or accountable manner. I set out to interview Tom and Sue Klebold, with the expectation that meeting them would help to illuminate their son's actions. The better I came to know the Klebolds, the more deeply mystified I became. Sue Klebold's kindness, before Dylan's death she worked with people with disabilities, would be the answered prayer of many a neglected or abused child. And Tom's bullish enthusiasm would lift anyone's tired spirits. Among the many families I've met in writing this book, the Klebolds are among those I would be most game to join. The last Sue Klebold heard from Dylan, the younger of her two children, was, "Bye," as he let the front door slam on his way to school on that 20th of April. In the middle of the day, Tom received a call about the shootings at school and learned that Dylan was a suspect. He called Sue, who told me, "I had a sudden vision of what Dylan might be doing, and so while every other mother in Littleton was praying that her child was safe, I gave the hardest prayer I ever made that he would kill himself, because then at least I would know that he wanted to die, and I wouldn't be left with all the questions I'd have if he got caught by a police bullet. I wished for my son to kill himself, and he did." As Littleton's period of mourning began, a carpenter from Illinois erected 15 crosses on a hillside near the school. Tom told me, "I was so buoyed by this. I wanted to be a part of the community, and I thought we could all grieve together." Sue remembered, "There were flowers, and Dylan's and Eric's crosses had as many as everyone else's." Then, the parents of some of the victims destroyed Dylan's and Eric's crosses.
"The shorthand was this," Tom said. 13 people died. 2 Nazis killed them, and the parents were responsible."
While the Klebolds faced a great deal of hostility, moments of unusual love also surfaced. Tom said, "A few weeks after Columbine happened, I got a hug from the checkout clerk at Home Depot. Neighbors brought us food, and when I took my car in to have a bent wheel fixed, the mechanic said to me, 'Well, at least you didn't change your name.'
He respected that. Investigations over the ensuing months revealed an atmosphere of bullying at Columbine. Unless you were a part of the in-crowd and had your athletic resume, you had no status, Tom said. The whole social pattern at Columbine was unfair, and Dylan couldn't do anything about it. That would cause enough anger in a sensitive kid to make him retaliate. Unbeknownst to the Klebolds, Dylan had experienced significant humiliation at school, though he was 6'4" and not easy to push around. He had come home one day with ketchup spots all over his shirt, and when his mother asked what had happened, he said he'd had the worst day of his life and didn't want to talk about it. Months after his death, she learned of an incident in which Dylan and Eric had apparently been shoved and squirted with ketchup by kids calling them fags. It hurt so much that I'd seen the remnants of that day and hadn't helped him. When Tom went to pick up Dylan's car from the police station a few weeks after the event, one of the officers said to him,
"My son came home from that school one day, and they'd set his hair on fire right in the hall. His whole scalp was burned. I wanted to take that school apart brick by brick, but he said it would only make it worse."
A year after the massacre, the police turned over Dylan's journals to the Klebolds, who hadn't known of their existence. "Dylan's writing is full of 'I'm smarter than they are,'" Sue said. "He experienced disdain for the people who were mistreating him. He liked to think of himself as perfect, I think, and that grandiosity came through in the shootings." In writings that go back to his sophomore year, she said, "He talks like a thoughtful, introspective, depressed kid, mostly about how he has a crush on somebody and she doesn't know he's alive. 3 months before the tragedy, he's talking about how he wants to die, and he says, 'I might do an NBK with Eric.'" She learned that NBK stood for Natural Born Killers. "I was surprised that the Klebolds had stayed in the town where they had been party to so much anguish. If we had moved and changed our names, the press would have figured it out. Here, at least, I had people who liked me as me, and people who had liked Dylan, and that was what I needed, especially people who had liked Dylan." I ventured that it must have been hard to keep loving Dylan through the aftermath, and Sue replied, "Trying to understand was hard. Coping with the loss was hard. But loving him? No. That was always easy for me." The Klebolds were heartened by unanticipated kindnesses, but the prospect of a normal life remains elusive. Sue recounted a recent trip to the supermarket when the checkout clerk had verified her name on her driver's license. "And then," she says, "Klebold, did you know him?" And I say, "He was my son." And then she started in with, "It was the work of Satan." And I'm thinking, "Please, let's bag the groceries here." As I leave the store, she's yelling out after me about how she's praying for me. It wears you down. They showed me family photo albums and home videos. I was particularly struck by a video of Dylan on his way to his prom 3 days before the massacre. He's a little churlish in the mode of adolescence, but also has a sweetness about him. He seems like a nice kid. "Dad, why are you filming this?" he asks. Then he laughs and says, "Well, someday I'll watch it again, and I'll wonder what I was thinking." Near the end of the video, he says, "I'll never have kids. Kids just mess up your life." The sudden angry moment comes out of nowhere and evaporates just as fast. From the day of the bloodbath, the 20th of April, until the following October, the Klebolds knew few details about what had transpired, except that Dylan was at the shooting and supposedly committed suicide. Then came the police report, and they saw the basement tapes, which Dylan and Eric had deliberately left behind. They reveal a Dylan unrelated to the young man in the prom video, someone spewing hatred, full of self-aggrandizing rage. "Seeing those videos was as traumatic as the original event. When I saw his disdain for the world, I almost hated my son. On these tapes is one moment of kindness. When Eric mentions their parents, Dylan says, "My parents have been good to me. I don't want to browse there." If you take Tom and Sue back to their prelapsarian memories, ease creeps into their voices. Sue said, "He was a pretty close to perfect child. At 3, he could already count to 110 and would use refrigerator magnets to make equations. He liked mazes. He liked word searches. He played chess with Tom. He was just a delight." Sue looked at me sideways, then said quietly, "You can't imagine how long it's been since I had a chance to brag about my son." Only one incident with Dylan, the year before the massacre, suggested something might be amiss. The spring of his junior year, Dylan went driving with Eric. They stopped at a parking lot and noticed a van with video equipment in the front seat. They grabbed a rock, broke the window, stole the equipment, then turned on their interior lights to inspect their haul. When a policeman stopped to see what was going on, Dylan confessed to the theft almost immediately. The police released the boys back to their parents' custody and put them in a program which aims to help juveniles avoid a criminal record by assigning them community service, educational directives, and restitution. With hindsight, Sue believes that this putative act of mercy was a mean trick of fate. Had they gone to jail, the boys would have been separated and out of the school where they felt debased. When Tom went for a walk the next day with Dylan, he was startled by his son's fury about the arrest.
"He felt so above it all, totally justified in what he'd done," Tom said. "The morality of the whole thing escaped him."
After Columbine, Sue had a client who was blind, had only one hand, had just lost her job, and was facing trouble at home. She said, "I may have my problems, but I wouldn't trade places with you for anything in the world." I laughed. All those years, I've worked with people with disabilities and thought, "Thank God I can see. Thank God I can walk. Thank God I can scratch my head and feed myself." And I'm thinking, how funny it is how we all use one another to feel better. When I mentioned to the Klebolds that I thought they spoke with an extraordinary clarity about their situation, Tom said,
"We're able to be open and honest about those things because our son is dead. His story is complete."
A few years after we first met, Sue said to me, "When it first happened, I used to wish that I had never had children, that I had never married. But over time, I've come to feel that, for myself, I am glad I had kids and glad I had the kids I did. Because the love for them, even at the price of this pain, has been the single greatest joy of my life. And when I say that, I am speaking of my own pain and not of the pain of other people. But I accept my own pain. Life is full of suffering, and this is mine. I know it would have been better for the world if Dylan had never been born. But I believe it would not have been better for me."
Kerry Shale was reading from Far From the Tree by Andrew Solomon. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. Last week on Radio 4, Claire Balding continued her series of ramblings by walking in Derbyshire. She was in the company of two long-term friends, Christine Valentine and Tracy Standring. As they walked, they talked about the nature of friendship and the vital role that walking has played in their lives.
"I used to look after my mum. And Mum died in January, so it was a case of having to focus on something. And because I had so much time on my hands, it was a case of what do we do? So it was a case of getting Christine roped in on it."
You can still catch that edition of Ramblings on the Radio 4 website. And if that whets your appetite for the outdoors, later today, Claire will be walking and talking to the actress and singer Toya Wilcox in rural Worcestershire. Ramblings is here on BBC Radio 4 at 3 o'clock this afternoon. After the news, we bring you Woman's Hour.